Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Donald Trump's call to ban all Muslims from the United States continues to receive international headlines. On today's Media Roundtable, we are joined by three reporters who are taking different angles on Trump's ban. Joshua Holland reports that people like Trump are engaging in the kind of demagoguery that only encourages discrimination and violence against Muslims. Yesterday's Washington Post reports that religious and civil rights groups are seeing a rise in physical attacks on Muslims across the United States in recent weeks. We will talk about what recently happened at Chabot Park in Castro Valley on today's show. Joshua Holland is a contributor to The Nation and a writing fellow with The Nation Institute. He's host of Politics and Reality Radio, and he joins us from New York. Hi, Josh. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Ruth. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. And Eli Clifton reports that Donald Trump's proposal is not new to the Beltway. It's part of a movement that has been funded for years by some of the country's biggest aerospace companies and conservative philanthropic foundations. Eli Clifton is a fellow at the Nation Institute who focuses on money and politics and foreign policy. He previously reported for the American Independent News Network, Think Progress, and the Interpress Service. Eli is co-author of the Center for American Progress's report, Fear, Inc., The Roots of the Islamophobia Network in America. And Eli Clifton joins us from Washington. Hi, Eli. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me on.
Nice to have you back. And we're also joined by Kia Markareshi. He writes about how the media are responding to Donald Trump's rhetoric, MSNBC's Morning Joe, which has a daily morning phone call with Donald Trump, recently finally cut him off, and the Huffington Post made a policy change in the way that it covers Donald Trump. Kia Markareshi is VanityFair.com story editor and associate director of audience development, and Kia joins us from New York. Hi, Kia. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you, and it's great to have all of you. So as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note. There's so much amazing reporting out there that doesn't always get the attention it deserves. So we like to highlight that reporting. And Joshua, why don't we start off with you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
You know, I would like to praise all of Liz Sly's reporting in the Washington Post about the rise of ISIS and attempts to combat it. This week she did a couple of pieces about talks in Syria among Syria's fractured opposition groups. They're trying to forge a common front. She talks about what's driving those efforts and also the obstacles that remain to seeing a united opposition against the Assad regime.
And what strikes you about Liz Sly's report, considering these issues get a lot of attention? And also, how does she report on what explains the rise of ISIS?
You know, one of the most important things she wrote, I think, was a story. It was titled The Hidden Hand Behind ISIS. She wrote this some months back, and she noted that all of the senior leadership of the Islamic State are former Iraqi military officers, and it's not hard to draw a line between the decision to disband Iraq security services and basically make all of these well-trained military leaders unemployed, and their subsequent rise within ISIS. They brought to this group not only military experience, but also an expanded network of smuggling routes and knowledge of how to circumvent financial sanctions and stuff like that.
It sounds like the piece Christopher Reuter of Der Spiegel reported on this months ago, and we had him on about that. We try to bring some context to this because I think that history is really important. So kudos to Liz Sly with the Washington Post, and that is Joshua Holland. He's a contributor to The Nation. And what about you, Eli? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, this is going to stand in stark contrast in terms of the gravitas of the coverage of ISIS that Joshua just described and my articles that interested me, which are that the ones that really caught my interest this week were the coverage done by both Gizmodo and Wired magazine, where both of them are sort of hot on the chasing one another, it seems like, in trying to come up with a positive identification of the creator of Bitcoin. I think it's been really interesting to watch. They both sort of honed in on this man, Craig Stephen Wright, in Australia. And the thing that is particularly fascinating is after Time Magazine's effort to identify the Bitcoin founder, as Satoshi Nakamoto, which was quite a while ago now, fell flat and was actually quite an embarrassing journalistic misstep. Now we're seeing two organizations that are not known necessarily for doing strong investigative work really trying to do it right this time around and present a compelling dossier on this individual.
And Eli, for those who aren't familiar with Bitcoin, can you just give us a quick synopsis and why do you think people should care about this issue?
Well, it's essentially a cryptocurrency, which is it exists completely independent of any government or any central fund backing it. And people can exchange it directly between individuals by email or even by writing down one Bitcoin hash, as it's known. I would say it wouldn't have significance except for the fact that the growth of the Bitcoin market, which is now worth many billions of dollars, does seem to suggest that people are placing an increasing weight on this currency and trust and faith in it, which is a strong separation from the traditional things that we've associated as currency, which are either precious metals or fiat currencies, in theory backed by governments. And this is something new, and it's enabled things like Silk Road, which have not been such a positive thing, which famously also resulted in some good investigative journalism and a federal case against the man who was running it. But in other cases, it's allowed anonymous donations to occur. I see it used increasingly by nonprofits taking it as a form of payment. And it seems like it's something that's going to be around much longer and in much greater value than many of us would have predicted several years ago.
All right. So kudos to Gizmodo and Wired for its reporting on Bitcoin. And that is Eli Clifton. He is a fellow at the Nation Institute. And what about you, Kia? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
I think it was actually published late last week, but Aisha Siddiqui, who I'm happy to have as a friend, she's the editor-in-chief of the New Inquiry. She published a piece in Vice, or on Vice, called Does America Deserve Malala, about Malala Yousafzai. And I think that it was just a very rich sort of dive through the history of Pakistan and how it relates to Malala's story and how it relates to Western involvement in the region. And it sort of gets at that feeling about if you've ever felt uncomfortable by some of the adulation heaped on Malala, which of course she deserves, but by leaders of countries or by companies that have in some way or other arguably contributed to the dire circumstances of her life story, I think Aisha's piece is a really important look at that history.
Well, I recently saw the documentary about her, so it sounds like this piece would be a good follow-up.
Yeah, and she actually interviewed the director as well, and I think she was very fair to his perspective. She didn't agree with it, but it was about that as well.
All right, so Aisha Siddiqui, is that right?
I'm sorry?
Is that her name, Aisha Siddiqui?
Oh, Aisha Siddiqui, yes.
Siddiqui, okay.
Yeah.
She writes for Vice. Thank you for that one. That sounds good. And that is Kia Makareshi. He is VanityFair.com's story editor. And we will put links to all of these stories at yourcallradio.org. All right, so let's dive in and talk about Donald Trump. I have to say, we were talking about this yesterday. We've never dedicated an entire show to Donald Trump on Your Call. But we decided to talk about this today because of not only this call to ban all Muslims, but the fact is he still is at the top of the Republican race. He could very well get the nomination. And now we are hearing reports. The Washington Post is reporting that the Republicans are actually preparing for a contested convention. So there's a lot to discuss. He is getting coverage. He's dominating the coverage in every news outlet from the left to the right. And I'd like to ask all of you, because you did take different angles on his recent call to ban all Muslims from the U.S., how do you decide how to cover someone like Donald Trump? Josh, your recent piece is about demagoguery that encourages discrimination and violence against Muslims, and we are seeing this from New York to California. So how do you decide what angle to take?
Well, it seemed to me to be an obvious approach to talk about the realities of America's Muslim community, because there's this, Donald Trump is, I think, symptomatic of a larger outburst of xenophobia and bigotry and Islamophobia in the wake of both Paris and San Bernardino. And indeed, we saw this after the 9/11 attacks as well. The thing that I find striking is that all the empirical evidence that's available to us, multiple surveys, shows that America's Muslim community is, in a sense, a model Muslim community. And I'm hesitant to you know, say a model minority, but it's true that the Wall Street Journal's conservative editorial page said as much. They said they're models for Muslims everywhere. And any way you slice it, you can look at you know, educational attainment, employment. We have this small, relatively small community within the United States that is very well assimilated, that yearns to be part of the mainstream, that wants to participate in the so-called American dream. And these are the people being demonized by Donald Trump right now. It's, you know, not just Trump, but certainly he's the most visible and vocal advocate of that position.
Yesterday, the Washington Post has a piece, and the lead is, "From Sea to Shining Sea, Muslim Americans are coming under attack. In New York City, a shop owner was savagely beaten Saturday by a stranger promising to, quote, kill Muslims. In California, Castro Valley at Chabot Park, a man was playing volleyball and praying in the park on Sunday. A woman accused him of being a terrorist, struck him, and splashed him in the face with coffee. And in Philadelphia, a severed pig's head was tossed outside of a mosque on Monday." Kia, you have a story about how the media are reporting on this. Are you finding that more media outlets are connecting the dots and coming out and saying that obviously these kinds of words and Islamophobia, this kind of talk has consequences, real consequences?
I think it depends on the type of media outlet and the type of reporting that's being done. I think Eli, for example, I'm sure we're going to talk about his work, has done some incredible investigations into, you know, the rhetoric and where it comes from and who's funding it. And I think that that is being tied with the reality of these incidents that are happening at mosques around the country to young Muslim students in upstate New York and different areas. But I do think that the media for a long time, and I say this as somebody who's part of the media, struggled with how overtly they could make those connections, or whether they should, or if they should just report on what he was saying, or if they should just treat Trump as a character, as an entertainment figure, like the Huffington Post tried to do. So I think, you know, it depends on the outlet, but we have been seeing, I think the Times has been more aggressive than usual, maybe, in their descriptions of him and his rhetoric. BuzzFeed's Ben Smith just announced, I think it was yesterday, that he gave his staff permission to call Trump a bigot on Twitter, essentially, which would otherwise be a violation of their social media policy. So I think the media is really grappling and struggling with how to approach this story in a way that encapsulates, in some ways, the horror of it, but also the context surrounding it.
Because you reported that the Huffington Post has been covering Donald Trump in its entertainment section since July. Ryan Grimm, the Washington bureau chief for the Huffington Post, we've had him on many times, says that Trump's campaign is a sideshow. "We will not take the bait. If you're interested in what Donald has to say, you'll find it next to our stories on the Kardashians and the Bachelorette." But the Huffington Post has taken a different stance now. Arianna Huffington issued a change in policy. How are they now going to cover Donald Trump?
Yeah, so, and I should say, full disclosure, I worked with Ryan and a lot of great people at the Huffington Post for a few years, but I think they're just sort of throwing up their hands, and it's going back into the politics section, because Arianna wrote that she thinks his rhetoric is dangerous and is catching enough of an audience to, I guess, be a real force. I think the question that comes out of that is just whether that was a good idea and whether the mainstream media, as the Republicans or some candidates love to say, whether their dismissal of Trump as a joke or a sideshow sort of just plays into his vibe, which is that, you know, nobody respects me, nobody respects you, come with me, we're going to take back this country. So it's an interesting twist.
And Eli, before we talk about your foreign policy piece that follows the money, and this is really interesting, I haven't really seen this reported in many places, what are your thoughts about angles reporters are taking, and are you seeing many reporters diving into the fact that words do have consequences?
Biggest challenge in covering Trump, which I've discussed with a few other journalists as well, is that, you know, there is a certain formula for writing about a presidential candidate, or really any politician who's, you know, striking out in a direction that sort of sets them apart from the field, which is that you try to place them in a political movement or an ideology, and track how they developed over the years and wound up where they did. And the challenge with Trump is that, you know, he operates pretty much independent of ideology. His politics, as have been well documented, swing all over the place. And if you want to have any predictive insights into what he'll do next, the only way really to characterize him is that he engages in short-term rational self-interest. He will say whatever he believes the polls will reward him for, or his base, as it is, would reward him for. And in that sense, his words have very little consequence, or he feels very little consequence for his words, beyond purely wanting to drive up his own numbers and appeal to an angry right-wing base, which he's at this point captured better than any other politician in the GOP.
Eli Clifton is a fellow at the Nation Institute who focuses on money and politics. He's got a piece in Foreign Policy called Meet Donald Trump's Islamophobia Expert. We're also joined by Kia Makareshi. He is VanityFair.com story editor, and he has a piece, Let's Watch the Media Grapple with Donald Trump's Proposed Muslim Ban. And Joshua Holland is a contributor to The Nation and a writing fellow with The Nation Institute. He's also the host of Politics and Reality Radio. And Josh has a piece, The Truth About American Muslims. And today we are talking about how the media are reporting on today's media climate. And we'd love to hear from you. What do you make of the coverage about the call to ban all Muslims from the United States? Are you seeing stories connecting the dots and looking at the fact that words have consequences? We are now seeing a lot of attacks against Muslims across the country. We'd love to give you a call. How do you think we should report on Donald Trump? We haven't done much of it, frankly, and we decided to talk about this today because he is at the top of the GOP race, and now a lot of reports are looking at the fact that the GOP is preparing for a contested convention. So what are your thoughts on these issues and media coverage of these issues? 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Eli, let's talk about what you found when you followed the money. You report that Donald Trump's proposal is not new to the Beltway. It is part of a movement that's been funded for years by some of the country's biggest aerospace companies and conservative philanthropic foundations. Why did you decide to take this angle, and what did you find?
Well, this is actually kind of an interesting moment when I saw Frank Gaffney, the Center for Security Policy, pop up as one of the two sources that Donald Trump pointed to. The other source, incidentally, that Trump pointed to was supposedly, he said, that Pew Research Center polls showed that, quote, there is great hatred toward Americans by large segments of the Muslim population. He didn't cite an individual poll by Pew, and the Pew Research Center basically told me that they don't know what he's talking about, since he doesn't even say which of their pieces of research he believes justify that statement. But the thing that fascinated me was that Frank Gaffney and the Center for Security Policy popped up. And these are somebody who I've tracked for years. As you mentioned at the beginning of the show, I co-authored a report by the Center for American Progress where we looked at how $40 million across roughly 10 years had trickled from, in this case, mainly conservative philanthropic foundations like the Lyndon Harry Bradley Foundation, the SCAIF Foundations, to a network of organizations, mostly in Washington, a few in New York, and a few elsewhere, that were slowly building up this network of pseudo-experts on Islam who were really selling Islamophobia. These were the people who activated together to bring us the controversy about the so-called Ground Zero Mosque in Lower Manhattan. And a lot of these people were the ones who also have tried to suggest that Barack Obama, for instance, is actually a Muslim. And Gaffney really, really fits in that. In if anything, he's a central character in it. And back in 2008, he was writing that there's evidence that Obama was born in Kenya. And he's been writing that Huma Abedin, Hillary Clinton's aide, was a Muslim Brotherhood operative. And he's even gone so far as to claim that the Missile Defense Agency logo appears to reflect a morphing of the Islamic crescent and star with the Obama campaign logo, which he describes as part of a, quote, worrying pattern of official U.S. submission to Islam. But it's important to remember that Gaffney really operates on the fringe of even the Republican Party. Back in 2011, he was banned from the Conservative Political Action Conference, which is a major Republican and right-wing event in Washington, after he accused two of the event's organizers, former George W. Bush administration official Suhail Khan and anti-tax activist Grover Norquist of being Muslim Brotherhood infiltrators. So he's really on the fringes, which is why it surprised me even more to find out that I already knew that he was receiving money from these right-wing foundations. But then about a year ago, I found out that he was actually also receiving funding from aerospace contractors like Boeing, General Dynamics, Lockheed, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, and General Electric. And to me, that was pretty fascinating because it was this intersection of really the arms industry and Gaffney's hysteria and conspiracy theorizing. And I think that that does reflect that this is a movement that's been going on in Washington for longer than most of us have been aware of. It has more mainstream support in Washington than many of us are aware of. And only now does it come out in the mainstream and we see we have the front runner in the Republican primary campaign using this material to justify banning Muslims from immigrating to the United States, and we're shocked. But this is something that's been happening, and it hasn't been, and it's been happening in our nation's capital for years.
Well, and so, just to make sure we have all the facts right, Donald Trump cited the work of the Center for Security Policy. This is a think tank that is headed up by Frank Gaffney, who's a former Reagan administration defense official. I just want to get that clear because we threw in a lot of names there. Josh, what are your thoughts about that and Eli's argument that this rhetoric coming from Donald Trump is getting so much attention and being criticized by extremely conservative members on Capitol Hill? But as Eli says, this really isn't new.
Well, I think that's an important point to stress. And it's been, I've certainly noted that we've seen sort of condemnations from Donald Trump's fellow candidates. But when you step back and you look at their own positions, these same candidates who are saying that his call to ban entry to Muslims are the same ones who are saying Ted Cruz, for example, proposed a 3-year moratorium on immigration from Muslim-majority countries. Marco Rubio has talked about shutting down mosques and other places where Muslims go for quote-unquote inspiration. So, and the entire field, Jeb Bush called for a sort of religious test for refugees to the United States. The entire field has been demagoguing Muslims in the wake of the Paris attacks. The Syrian refugee issue has been a really, I think, base and coarse kind of debate. And then for some reason, Donald Trump has given the media permission, I think, to call him out with a very different tone than everybody else. The other point that I'd make is that we have to give him some credit for his ability to influence the media coverage, the daily news cycle. This outrageous proposal that he dropped was something that he came out with just, I think, 3 hours after a big Monmouth poll came out showing that he had lost the lead in Iowa to Ted Cruz. In the early hours of Monday, everybody was talking about that. All the political reporters were talking about the Monmouth poll. By the time he came out with this, he effectively shifted the discussion to his proposals about Muslims.
That is Josh Holland, contributor to The Nation. Eli Clifton is a fellow at The Nation Institute, and Kia Makareshi is VanityFair.com's story editor. And today it is our media roundtable. We'd love to hear from you. What do you make of, well, there's so many angles, but Donald Trump's call to ban all Muslims following the money, are you seeing any of that reported? And how do you think the media should cover Donald Trump at this time? We'd love to hear from you. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, a program that relies on engaged listeners. We invite you to join today's conversation by calling toll-free 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255, or feel free to post your question or comment at yourcallradio.org. You can also send an email, question if you wish, to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock, it's Reveal. Following that at noon, the Tavis Smiley Show. And at noon today, Latino USA here on KALW, Local Public Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we are talking about how poor and low-income communities are being affected by the Bay Area's economic boom. One in four Bay Area families are living in poverty. The top 5% of the wealthiest households earn 23% of the total income in the Bay Area, and nonprofits are struggling to keep up with demand. So how should city governments respond, and what changes are you seeing? That is on Monday. And in fact, Joshua Holland, today's guest, has a great piece about growing inequality, which is not getting as much attention because so much attention is on Donald Trump. But we will ask Josh about that later in the show. Josh is a contributor to The Nation and a writing fellow at The Nation Institute. Eli Clifton is a fellow at The Nation Institute who focuses on money and politics. He is co-author of the Center for American Progress's report, Fear, Inc., The Roots of the Islamophobia Network in America. And Kia Makareshi is story editor with VanityFair.com. And we have full lines. Let's hear from Ruby in Santa Clara. Hi, Ruby. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for taking my calling. I am just blown away. You know, it's all self-promotion. What this dude is doing, it's like an avalanche or a fire or an explosion. All he cares about is spell it right. Sure, he believes what he is saying, but, you know, he's buying into the feeling in Iowa. How is he doing in New Hampshire? Maybe he's at the top there. How is he doing in South Carolina? But the big deal is, how is he doing in Ohio? Do any of you know how he's doing in Ohio? And as long as he keeps exploding all over the place, the media are going to keep covering it. What else can they do?
Well, like I said, every morning on MSNBC, Joe Scarborough has a phone call with Donald Trump. And according to Kia's reporting, he recently hung up on him. What about that? Does anybody know how he's doing in Ohio?
I think according to the Real Clear Politics average, Trump is up by 3.4. Oh, I'm sorry. Trump has 25% of likely voters. Cruz is the next highest at 22%.
Okay, so at this point, he's up a bit above Ted Cruz. Is that what we're seeing mostly in those states?
Yes.
Okay.
Except in the Monmouth poll that Cruz is actually ahead of him by 5 points.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Ruby. What about, have you all been following the reporting that's coming out about Republican officials and leading figures in the GOP preparing for the possibility of a brokered convention as Trump sits atop the polls? This is a piece from The Washington Post. Eli, have you been following that?
Oh, I certainly saw the Washington Post piece today. My first knee-jerk reaction was to say that there's nothing that those of us in the media would like more than that, because that would certainly be an entertaining and a must-watch convention. I would defer to some of the other panelists about the likelihood of it happening. I guess just my only thought is that this is something that does come up every cycle, it seems like, increasingly as these primaries become more heavily and heavily contested with a broader field racing. I think it's extremely unlikely, but it's an interesting thing to keep in mind, and I'm sure that the GOP establishment wants to at least keep that option on the table.
Right, and they don't want him to run as an independent. Kia, what do you think about this reporting?
I mean, I think it was very interesting. I read that with great interest. I think it, at the end of the day, does play into the narrative that Trump, Cruz, and Carson are pushing, which is that, you know, they're not just declaring war on Muslim Americans or Muslim refugees or Democrats. Even there's no one else that they would want to answer to. They don't agree with the Republican establishment, who certainly would like to get rid of them at this point in the race. So it's a little uncomfortable to watch, but also sort of entertaining, I suppose.
And Josh?
Well, I would echo what Eli said, which is that I don't recall a presidential election cycle where there wasn't some columns about this time where we might finally see a brokered convention, the first since the 1970s. Having said that, and I read the piece this morning by Robert Costa, it does seem like there is a plausible path to getting there. As they said, you could see a situation where several of these candidates win an early state. Then they have very little incentive to get out with the, you know, if they have a backer or two willing to open up their wallets to keep them in the race, they certainly can keep in the race. But it's been an odd race from a structural perspective in that you have a leading candidate who has maintained a fairly consistent lead for a long stretch of time, who everybody thinks is going to crash and burn at some point. So, you know, the conventional wisdom is that Trump is going to finally say something that goes overboard and people will flee him, and where do they go? What this creates for the other candidates, maybe at polling at 5 or 6%, is to hang in there and see how the race gets reshuffled.
Like a Jeb Bush, for example, because Jeb Bush is hardly getting any media attention these days.
There's a number of candidates who I think in a normal, well, I hate to say a normal cycle, in a cycle where the front runner was somebody who was acceptable to the various factions within the Republican Party, if that kind of person had a stable lead, there are a number of candidates who I think would have dropped out at this point.
Well, thank you for calling, Ruby. Let's go next to Nancy in Berkeley. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I think this whole thing with Donald Trump is just insane. Every time he brushes his teeth, it's covered from teeth to teeth. And I think the only way to maybe get rid of this monster is to just have a complete news blackout. Just don't cover anything he says for maybe, well, forever, but maybe for a month. You know, he doesn't say anything that needs to be covered. He has no ideas except bad ones, and it just incites people, and he gets free coverage. He doesn't have to pay a penny for for advertising or anything. He's just always there, and I think it's time where he isn't there.
Well, you bring up two good points, and Truth Dig has a piece called "Hear a Network CEO Reveal in the Amazing Profits of Candidates Throwing Crap at Each Other." This week, CBS Corporation Chief Executive Les Moonves said during an investor presentation that the corporate media, which stands to benefit nicely from the $5 billion 2016 presidential election, it's expected to cost $5 billion, is egging on that same divisive rhetoric. He said, quote, "We love having all 16 Republican candidates throwing crap at each other. It's great. The more they spend, the better it is for us," end quote. Josh, I think that comment really says it all, because these candidates are going to not only spend a ton of money on ads, but all of the debates, the Republican debates especially, are making a lot of money for the networks.
You've seen huge audiences for these Republican debates, to a lesser degree even for the Democratic debates. But when you see 25 million people tune into a Republican debate, then obviously it's unlikely that the media is going to stop covering them. But I would just add that Trump supporters, I'm not sure that they're consuming so-called mainstream corporate media. There is a conservative media site like Breitbart have been very aggressive in promoting Trump's candidacy, and I think that those are places where the people who are likely to support Trump are more likely to go for their information. So even if we all said, well, we'll stop covering Trump, his message would get out. And of course, he's an adept user of social media. He's been able to kind of circumvent the classic structure of a campaign where you have political consultants that vet all your statements. He just goes on Twitter and lobs bombs. And it's very hard for the other campaigns to keep up with that.
Kia, what are your thoughts about this quote from the CBS CEO, Les Moonves? Because over the last couple months, a lot of listeners have called in saying, can you please follow the money and look at where these candidates are spending their money? So you've got that, but then you also have the money that the cable outlets are bringing in from advertising because people are tuning in to see this.
Right. I'm a little hesitant with the idea that a lot of political coverage or even political intrigue would be a problem. I think the problem is the rhetoric. So, of course, cable news companies, like any other companies, have an interest to print as much money as possible. But it's an election cycle. I mean, they need to be covering the election. I saw a thing on Facebook from Facebook today that Trump is 83% of the overall conversation about the election on Facebook. Next is Hillary at 10%. So I think whether that's caused by the media, whether the media is reflecting back what its audience wants, which is sort of a broader issue, I think, in today's media, it's a little bit hard to say. But I think also what Josh said is right, is that it's about access, too. I mean, not a lot of candidates want the risk or the exposure of having a standing call with a cable news host or with Joe Scarborough. I think that Trump one of his, I guess, strengths or the things that's appealing to his supporters is that he's actually really politically fearless. I mean, you could say he's craven, but he doesn't fear any risk. He seems to show up to events and sort of ad lib with limited understanding of the issues. And, you know, you're not going to get Hillary Clinton talking to that many reporters. I mean, the press has been having the opposite problem with her. So I think a little bit of it is just being available and always being available to say something incredibly controversial.
Eli, what are your thoughts? Rolling Stone's Matt Taibbi writes, quote, Trump does politics in just the way that cable news reports on it, disjointedly, without empathy or nuance or complexity. Unlike polished American politicos, Donald Trump is a TV watcher and he knows how to speak to his people, end quote. Eli, what's your take?
Well, I think Matt Taibbi is dead on with that, that Trump has an amazing knowledge and grasp of how to work the media, particularly the mainstream media. And I think that, you know, we obviously like to demonize the mainstream corporate media, but, you know, let's just be clear that for the most part, they've treated him, I would not say that they've treated him warmly, that he certainly, as you say, his morning call-in on Morning Joe seems to have come to an end of some sort, and he's met with a fair amount of hostility. He gets criticized. The remarkable thing is that his numbers continue to stay the same or grow when he does get into feuds with the mainstream media. He was trying to shake down CNN for $5 million to appear in the next debate, something he eventually backed down from, so much for being the amazing negotiator. But it's really worth noting here that it hasn't been positive coverage necessarily. It's just any coverage, and that's what he seeks out. I would also I always try to tell people that I try to stay optimistic about the Trump phenomenon, which is that there might be something extremely healthy about this, that he's saying the things that were thought and that were always said in more of a coded or a politically correct, for lack of a better term, manner in the Republican Party and on the far right. The Islamophobia that he just expressed, suggesting that we put a ban on Muslim immigration, it's not a new proposal. It's not something that this is the first time it's been said. This is something that's been said for years. He, however, takes away any of the sweetener on it and makes it, very brash, because that's his style. He gets the big backlash he wants, and it seems to work for him. But at least we're having this debate out in the open now. The Republican Party has to confront the Islamophobia that's been inside of it for years now. And the mainstream media is also covering Islamophobia, frankly, in ways that I don't think they have until pretty much this time right now.
And it's been getting some coverage in the alternative media. In Truthout, Henry Giroux writes, what almost none of the presidential candidates or mainstream political pundits have admitted is not only that Trump's comments form a discourse of hate, bigotry, and exclusion, but also that such expressions of racism and fascism are resonating deeply in a landscape of U.S. culture and politics crafted by 40 years of conservative counter-revolution. And he says also what's alarming is how many corporate media figures and intellectuals were defending Trump. So it kind of goes along with what you were saying, Eli. We've been reading about this a bit in the alternative media. Do you think it'll make its way eventually into the mainstream?
I think it already has. I think the fact that when you tune in to CNN now and you see a confrontational interview occurring with Frank Gaffney, I think it was maybe Don Lemon even, that was tearing apart the polling methodology used by the Center for Security Policy. First of all, nobody would have been talking about Frank Gaffney and Frank Gaffney's polling on CNN a year ago. And the fact that now it's also being treated not just as, you know, a terrorism expert, but as a potential problem and a fringe character who has somehow made it onto the mainstream and into the political discourse at this level as a problem is it's something brand new. I think it's healthy.
Eli Clifton is a fellow at the Nation Institute who focuses on money and politics and U.S. foreign policy. He's co-author of the Center for American Progress's report, Fear, Inc., The Roots of the Islamophobia Network in America. Kia Makareshi is story editor with VanityFair.com, and Josh Holland is a contributor to the Nation and a writing fellow with the Nation Institute. And we'd love to hear from you. What do you think about media coverage of Donald Trump, Islamophobia, xenophobia, the attacks that we are seeing across the country on Muslims, and how do you think we should cover Donald Trump. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We have an email from Mary Jane that says the media we're talking about here may not and probably is not the media being accessed by Trump's followers. We can keep on writing and reading editorial and excellent pieces in all of these outlets, but how do we get his followers, and what is a way to possibly change their response to his rhetoric? Is it even possible? Josh, what are your thoughts on that?
I'm very doubtful that it is possible. That's the $64,000 question that a lot of Republican media consultants, campaign consultants, are trying to figure out. Frank Luntz had a focus group. It was reported by Dave Weigel in the Washington Post this week. They talked to 30 Trump supporters and also some people who had been supporting him earlier but then had moved away from him. And Luntz threw every negative narrative he could possibly figure out at this focus group. And what he found was that the more he said, the more they liked him. And what he also found that there was an innate distrust, as the email writer said, a strong and innate distrust of the so-called mainstream media among this group, and that they are getting their information indeed from the conservative alternative media. That's the sources. Those are the sources that they trust.
Eli or Kia, do you want to jump in there? Anything to add?
Yeah, I think
Kia.
Sorry, one big thing to keep in mind is how most people are getting their news now. So, yes, these cable networks have massive audiences, but for pretty much any large-scale website, or even Vanity Fair's website, or I'm sure The Nation's website, most of the readers are coming in through social media, right? And a lot of those feeds are things that are algorithmically tweaked to suit your interests. So what we're seeing in these debates is just, I think there was a visualization that came out about the gun control debate, that the sort of stuff, links, articles, even statuses from friends, that people who are anti-gun control are seeing are completely different than what people who are pro-gun control are seeing. So we have this sort of fractured media landscape, and it becomes this echo chamber where at the end of the day you talk to people who are already agreeing with you, or even more out there on opinions that you might harbor. And I don't think that they're necessarily reading investigative pieces in Foreign Policy or The Nation as much as maybe we wish that they would.
So how do you think that shapes the discussion?
Well, it's dangerous, right? Because the whole idea is that it's very easy to have a belief if the only people who you're talking with or debating with are shades of that same belief. I think it's very difficult for the media in general to break out past that and sort of talk to people who are on the other side. I think in the piece that Josh is referencing, the Frank Luntz focus group, you know, some of the stuff that you're seeing is just so shocking. Like, if I could just read you one really quick quote, one of the Trump supporters described Obama. He said, and excuse language, he said, "I would not only urinate on him if he was on fire, I would throw gas on him." Like, this is what somebody is saying about the president. They're probably not also reading what Maureen Dowd has to say, you know, in the New York Times. Mm-hmm.
Well, Mary,
and if I can just jump in, that gentleman who said that also believed that Obama had been sworn in on a Quran and had refused throughout his presidency to wear an American flag tent, which I think is indicative of the kind of media he's consuming.
Mary Jane ends her email by saying the media has to take responsibility for how much coverage Trump has been given, how his fires have been stoked by their desire to cash in on the profits of more readership just by the mention of his name on the first page. And I just want to make sure that we spend a little more time before we have to end about the consequences of his words. We talked about this earlier in the show when we started, but Josh, you wrote about this, and I feel like every other day now we're reading about an attack on Muslims. There was one in New York, the recent one at the Chabot Park in Castro Valley. Do you think that this is going to continue to get more coverage? And how do you think the media should cover these attacks?
Well, I mean, it's officials at the Council for Islamic, CARE, Council for American Islamic Relations, say that they're getting multiple reports of hate crimes every day. It's appalling. I don't know that there's a way to systematically expose it as connected to Trump, but it's obviously there's a kind of toxic brew of recent terrorist attacks with with this Republican primary in the background, and that kind of propels all of these narratives to the fore. So we're in a very ugly situation right now, but it's not the first time we've seen this. There were a number of hate crimes following the 9/11 attacks as well against Muslim Americans and people perceived to be Muslim Americans, including Sikhs.
Right. Well, thank you for that email. And let's hear from Marsha in Berkeley. Hi, Marsha. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks, Rose, for another great program. I'm hoping that your guests can address the issue of polling accuracy. And, I mean, especially as it relates to conducting it by landlines versus, cell phones, which so many younger people now use, and exclusively and without a landline, and how that skews things and whether or not they think that there's a representative sample being captured. And I'll take that response off if it's fine.
Okay. Eli, can you answer that question?
I mean, I know that certainly is been a concern for the past, I want to say, like 4 or 5 years as the number of people dropping their landlines has increased. Just from my own personal experience, I certainly am getting polling calls on my cell phone. I think there has been some effort to start to balance that out. But I would just, now, not to steer things back to my own wheelhouse here too much, but I would just add that in this conservative media, which is very siloed and it mostly doesn't include even Fox News. We're talking stuff, as we were discussing earlier, that gets distributed on social media. I've noticed there's a growing acceptance of polling which is not in any way scientific or up to the standards that we look at when we see, for instance, Real Clear Politics polls that are undertaken by trying to get representative samples and everything. And that really goes back to Frank Gaffney and the polling that Donald Trump was pointing to, which it turned out was an opt-in poll, which means that anybody who wanted to participate could, but they had to take the initiative on the Center for Security Policy or on the pollster's website, which they used to then say that something like 25% of American Muslims would support violence or terrorism, and that that's accepted, and that was, while widely pilloried on the left and on the mainstream media, who called it out for what it was, I think in these, in this sort of siloed media environment on that social media permits, those are accepted as fact.
Well, thank you for that. I also just wanted to mention, we haven't mentioned Bernie Sanders in the show today. A new CNN WMUR poll released on Wednesday shows Bernie Sanders with a 10-point lead over Hillary Clinton in New Hampshire. Not in Iowa, but in New Hampshire. So I just wanted to mention that. And then I wanted to ask you, Josh, because we're almost out of time, because Donald Trump is getting so much attention, so many other very important issues obviously are not. And I was really struck by a piece you wrote recently about growing inequality. And I thought you did an excellent job of really connecting the dots between growing inequality and the recent report that came out about more white people in middle America are either committing suicide or overdosing on drugs. Can you just give us a brief synopsis of what you found?
Well, you can't draw a direct causal relationship, but there was a report out last week by the Institute for Policy Studies that I looked at. It was basically revealing the degree to which our inequality continues to grow. So the top 20 individuals on the Forbes 400 list now own as much wealth as half of American households. So, there is with rising inequality comes, and there's quite a bit of data about this, comes a decrease in upward mobility, of social mobility. And one of the theories posited for this increase in mortality among middle-aged white persons are various social problems that come along with stress, with greater stress hormones being released. The increase in mortality is associated with suicide, drug addiction, alcohol abuse, things like that. So it's one of a number of social problems that has been attributed to rising inequality. And then, of course, you have this very difficult situation where a greater economic inequality results in greater political inequality, and the donor class is largely uninterested in the kinds of solutions that we might be looking at to address the problem.
That in many cases the overwhelming majority of Americans want but are not getting. And
that's right.
What strikes you, Josh? I mean, if you write about inequality, is that story getting as many clicks as the Donald Trump story? And how do your editors deal with that?
Well, I mean, there was a point last year when Thomas Piketty's book came out where there was quite a bit of attention on inequality. It has been raised certainly in the Democratic debates quite a bit. Obviously, the Trump phenomenon is like a hot phosphorus grenade that kind of overshadows other issues. It's not an issue that he's talking about. The New York Times did that analysis last week of 95,000 words that he had uttered in various campaign speeches, and they found that his whole message is about security threats of a wide variety of sorts, right? So broadly writ security threats. That's the focus that Trump has, and also that is largely overtaking the Republican debates in terms of overshadowing more traditional domestic policy areas.
And Eli, just quickly, what are you working on right now?
I'm working on right now looking more closely at the mega donors who are funding the super PACs behind some of the other Republican candidates other than Donald Trump.
Right.
You know, at least some of us are trying to change the tone a little bit away from Trump when we can.
Thank you.
And specifically, I just brought out a piece today about Paul Singer, his support of Marco Rubio, and how Singer had started to cultivate his own reputation as a very progressive Republican who supported same-sex marriage and various LGBT equality laws. And in his support of Marco Rubio, Rubio has said that actually Paul Singer doesn't talk to him about that.
Well, we'll look for that report. Eli Clifton is a fellow at the Nation Institute. Josh Holland is a contributor with the Nation. And Kia Makareshi is story editor with VanityFair.com. Thank you all for joining us. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we're talking about how poor and low-income communities are being affected by the Bay Area's economic boom. One in four Bay Area families are living in poverty, and the top 5% of the wealthiest households earn almost 23% of the total income in the Bay Area. Nonprofits serving those struggling to make ends meet cannot keep up with demand. So how should city governments respond, and what changes are you seeing? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.